The matter of Arthur Bergman, JSC. May we please have appearances?
Good afternoon. Maureen Bauman on behalf of the Advisory Committee on Judicial Conduct.
Good afternoon. Bruce Nagel, Mildred Rice, and Mike Porter, Sue Connors.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Bauman. And to both counsel, we have a motion to dismiss, but we also have argument if the court does not grant that motion as to what the appropriate discipline is, and I invite you both to argue both points. Please.
Thank you.
Justice Solomon will participate. He's watching the argument.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, members of the court. The ACJC, Advisory Committee on Judicial Conduct, correctly determined that respondents' initiation of an ex parte telephone call to a third-party witness in a pending matter violated Canon 3, Rule 3.8 of the Code of Judicial Conduct. The committee rejected respondents' defense that the communication did not constitute an ex parte one and was permissible based on two reasons. One, the scheduling exception to Rule 3.8, and also that it was not ex parte in that there was no actual contact between respondent and the witness. The exception to Canon 3, Rule 3.8, on which respondent relies, provides that settlement discussions, discussions regarding scheduling, and a judge's handling of emergent matters do not constitute, generally, ex parte communications. None of those exceptions apply here. The court has the actual transcript of respondent's voicemail. It's P1 in the exhibits. And the voicemail clearly states respondent's purpose in calling the witness was because he had a few questions about an affidavit that the witness submitted. A plain reading of Canon 3, Rule 3.8 evinces respondent's violation of its terms in attempting to communicate with Mr. Oskiersko, the third-party witness, about the matter pending before respondent. Respondent's conduct is not excused based on the fact that the witness was not there to take the call or didn't return the call. It is the initiation of that phone call that constitutes the violation of the code. In its presentment, the committee noted it could conceive of no circumstance where it would be permissible for a judge to talk to a witness ex parte, given the various judiciary personnel available to make that phone call. The committee stated, in the rare circumstances where such a communication may be warranted, those communications should occur on the record with notice to the parties and their counsel, neither of which occurred here. If the witness that responded contacted had not notified the trustee that he got that phone call from respondent, the matter would have never come to light. The second violation the committee found on behalf of the respondent was conducting an independent factual allegation. And respondent acknowledged in his answer and in stipulations that he conducted an independent factual investigation and instructed his law clerk to do the same without the party's knowledge to obtain information about the trustee's daughter. The committee found that respondent relied on this information that he obtained from his factual investigation when drawing negative inferences about the trustee's credibility and creating the appearance of impropriety of bias against the trustee in violation of Canon 1, Rule 1.1, Canon 2, Rule 2.1, and Canon 3, Rule 3.6C. In addition to respondent's ex parte communications with the witness, respondent was also charged with and acknowledged that this independent investigation he conducted was to obtain some additional information. Respondent, in relying on that independent factual investigation and why he said it was permissible, relies on his, he says he did that, and the reason it was permissible is because he was taking judicial notice of certain facts. If respondent intended to employ New Jersey Rule of Evidence 201, there were ways he should have gone about doing what he did. He notified the parties that he obtained this information. After he did it, he could have told them He got the information and allowed the parties to be heard on that issue. He never did that. In finding that respondent committed this misconduct, the ACJC applied the rationale in formal opinion 478 of the American Bar Association Standing Committee.
Ms. Bell, before you get there, can you clarify how precisely it came to the party's attention that he had done some investigation with respect to Ms. Dragon?
Yes, Chief Justice. During the course of the litigation, there were questions about reimbursement for some of the expenses that the trustee and his daughter incurred. Judge Bergman told the parties to submit certifications or affidavits from those people that did that work. The trustee did that. One of those certifications was from this individual, Ben Oskierko, and he did some landscaping services at the trustee's property that was the subject of this litigation. The individual, Mr. Oskierko, received a voicemail on his phone.
I was speaking about the allegation with respect to Ms. Dragon.
I'm sorry, with respect to?
Count three.
The independent factual? Again, it was the same way because it all stems from this phone call to the witness.
Please go ahead then.
So during that phone call, before he could make the phone call, the judge had to contact the witness. Looks on the invoice, there's no information. Respondent then proceeds to do his independent research. He checks with the Bureau of Vital Statistics. He looks at tax records. He looks at the Better Business Bureau records to try to find this company. It was called Boss Landscaping. Doesn't find anything about that. He knows the person's name from the company because it's in the affidavit he submitted. He then looks for information regarding that individual's name. Finds two people by that name. The judge concludes, without any information, that they're father and son. He gets a phone number for one of these individuals, places that call to that person, and that's that Ben Oskierko. And it was during that phone call that Judge Bergman said, I have some questions about your certification, give me a call, and he leaves the message. That information also led to the independent factual investigation, which forms the basis of count three, because the information the judge got came from his investigation. And without that investigation, he would have never been able to contact the witness.
I'm not sure if you answered the Chief Justice's specific question. With regard to the information regarding Ms. Dragon herself, how did the parties know that he was doing independent research to find out when she was married and all that information?
Check with the Registrar for Vital Statistics. Right. The check with the public real estate tax records. How do the parties first learn that he conducted that investigation?
Mr. Oskierko calls the trustee and said, I got this call from Judge Bergman. The trustees then calls his lawyer, who files a motion for disqualification of Judge Bergman, based in part on that ex parte conversation.
This is more complicated than I had in mind. When did the parties learn about this?
When Judge Bergman filed his supplemental certification statement of the record of his reasons. In there, he makes reference to tax records, to the trustee's daughter having a child, to the trustee's daughter purchasing a condominium and then selling it, and then living in this house. He would have not had any of that information but for the fact that he did this factual investigation, and the only parties only knew about it because the trustee's attorney filed the motion based on the call to the witness.
The argument your colleague has presented is that this had little bearing on the outcome of the matter in any event. These were just public records. Can you respond to that?
That might be the case, and perhaps Judge Bergman would have been able to rely on that had he gone about it the right way. None of those facts that Judge Bergman relied on in finding against the trustee were in the record. He would not have known any other way the information about the trustee's daughter. He would not have known that she owned her own house and sold it for not much of a profit. All of that information was not contained in the record. If the trustee's motion, again, in part based on the ex parte phone call, made some assumptions where the judge got the information, which turned out not to be true when the judge issued his supplemental statement of reasons. He referred to, as a matter of fact, he attached his independent factual investigation as exhibits to his order. Did I answer?
Please go ahead.
Okay. I was referring to the formal opinion of the ABA Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility, which stands for the proposition that judicial impartiality requires that a jurist consider only evidence presented on the record by the parties in court. And applying that rationale, the committee found that respondent failed to demonstrate judicial impartiality, and on ascertaining certain information concerning the trustee, his daughter, and the daughter's husband, he used that info, again, not part of the record, and used that against the trustee. And if you read Judge Bergman's opinion, his supplemental statement, there are many findings noted against the trustee's credibility. And the committee noted, in looking at the respondent's conduct in order to determine whether or not he did lack any impartiality, a reasonable, fully informed person may construe this conduct as indicative of respondent's bias against the trustee and question the legitimacy of the judicial process. Committee noted that judicial discipline in such circumstances warranted to remediate the harm and restore the public's confidence in the court system. As the appropriate quantum of discipline, the committee recommended that respondent be publicly disciplined. And the committee did find that the respondent, by clear and convincing evidence, violated Canon 1, Rule 1.1, Canon 2, Rule 2.1, Canon 3, Rule 3.6C, and Canon 3, Rule 3.8 of the Code of Judicial Conduct. I would be happy to answer any more questions the court may have.
Thank you, Ms. Bell.
I have a question.
Yes.
Are there any risks of a chilling effect on judges rendering opinions in which they rely on publicly available information that the parties have not cited? Let's say the judge, for example, cites to case law or even though they shouldn't, unpublished opinions that weren't in the briefs. Does the judge have to notify counsel ahead of time, I'm going to do this before I render a ruling, or is there any latitude for judges to rely on publicly available resources that are not part of the evidence or legal argument presented in the papers?
I would distinguish relying on case law from relying on facts, specific personal facts, such as Judge Bergman did here. Case law is readily available. I'm sure if the judge did rely on something that was not ever brought up by any of the parties, in that case, give the attorneys an opportunity to review the case. But here, the information that Judge Bergman obtained, yes, it's a matter of public record, but the way he went about it and the reason he wanted that information, I think, makes it distinguishable from case law that could be relied on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bell.
Thank you.
Mr. Nick.
Distinguished members of the court, we're here today on behalf of Judge Bergman to ask you to reject the findings of the advisory committee, to either dismiss this charge that has been recommended, dismiss the findings, or alternatively, if you are inclined in any way, shape, or form to accept those findings, either do not issue discipline or issue the least discipline that is cognizable under the rules. I'd like to set the stage for my arguments today with an internal contradiction within the opinion itself, which informs a great deal of what I'm about to address today. And that contradiction shows up in the way in which the advisory panel treated count one of the charge. Now, count one of the charge accused Judge Bergman of having lack of candor, in effect being dishonest in the explanation that he gave as to why he reached out to contact this particular witness. And that count was dismissed by the advisory panel, advisory committee, on the grounds that clear and convincing evidence was not present to charge him or, in effect, convict him of providing the committee with a false and untrue reason for reaching out. So if, in fact, they found that his explanation for why he did it did, in fact, have candor and, in fact, did not form the basis of an independent charge set forth in count one, then that finding will inform the court on the rest of my argument. So I will start, if I can, with the charge involving Canon 3.8, and that is the contact itself. And there are two independent grounds why that charge must be dismissed, especially in view of the finding that count one did not establish by clear and convincing evidence a charge of lack of candor, where the very basis of that charge was the reason he gives for reaching out in the first place. You cannot have those findings logically together. It cannot exist in this case. So there are two reasons. The first reason is very simply, there was no contact. Did he reach out? Of course he did. That's undisputed in this record. But there's not a case here in New Jersey, nor is there a case around the country where there has ever been discipline assessed against a judge where there has been no contact. There is no case here in New Jersey or any place in the country where there has not been the duality of the communication. The very reach out alone, standing on its own, is not sufficient. Canon 3.8 talks about communication. Communication is not a one-sided verb. Communication, by its very definition, requires there must be some contact. The two lead cases that we've relied upon, Goldfarb and the Seventh Circuit case, there was contact, not just a reach out. It was actual contact, a text message.
Contact when the recipient of the request gets a voicemail and listens to it?
No, because there is no response to the leaver of the message. There was no response. There was no communication between the judge and the witness. It was a one-sided reach out. Now, potentially, your honors may say, well, you know what? We're going to read this rule as simply saying you cannot, under any circumstance, even make that call. And I'm suggesting that that would be a punitive and an improper way of reading the rule. The plain language of that canon, 3.8, refers to communication. It does not say on the face of the rule or in the five comments to the rule, it does not say that the rule is violated simply by a reach out. It doesn't say that. And that sentence in the rule talks about initiation and communication. And I keep coming back to that word because communication cannot be one-sided, especially when it comes to a quasi-criminal charge, which is exactly what either an attorney ethic or judicial ethics charge is.
The judge reaches out and says the hearing will be at 10 o'clock on Tuesday. That's not a communication?
Well, first of all, that's one of the exceptions we're going to talk about. But
no, I understand that.
The answer is if he reaches out and leaves that alone, that is not deemed, in my reading of the rule, a communication. A communication needs, based upon the face of the rule and the case law around the country, it needs duality. That didn't exist here.
You have leaving the message or you have hearing the message. We know both happened. That's not a communication?
No, not a communication.
You send a letter to someone, that's not a communication?
Not as envisioned by this rule. This rule talks about an ex parte communication. Communication means there must be a response. There must be another party to the discussion, to the contact. The fact that he reached out and left a message, that's not sufficient, at least until today, in our case law around the country. There's not, again, and I don't mean to kick a dead horse, but there is not even a single case, advisory or otherwise, here or in the United States, which suggests that that could result in a charge to the judge. And now I'd like to link that to the second part of the argument. Again, I said there's two separate independent grounds.
Can I ask you to pause for a second before you do that? Suppose an adversary of yours in a case and it reaches out to a judge, leaves an hour-long message for the judge. They don't speak. The judge listens to it in its entirety. Judge comes out to the bench next time and says, I just want you to know this happened, but there's been no ex-party communications between us because I never spoke to the person. Let's move on. Are you satisfied with that?
I am, yeah. Certainly. I'm satisfied that
that's... Satisfied that your adversary got an hour's worth of the judge's ear without...
I'm satisfied that it's not a violation. Am I satisfied that potentially I've got to deal with the contents of it? That's a different issue. But as far as what I'm here for today, on that model that Your Honor gives us, I'm satisfied that that is not a communication.
So okay for a judge, following up on Justice Pierre-Louis' comment, to read a brief written by one side only to the judge without the other side being copied, not an ex-party contact between the two.
And again, with respect, obviously, I have difficulty comparing the models because, again, I'm talking about a judge reaching out, and Your Honor's hypothetical deals with a lawyer leaving a message with the judge. So, again, from a judicial ethics point of view, I don't find anything wrong if a judge reaches out and never, ever makes contact. In the context of this case, and I'm going to talk about two other reasons why I think that this does not, as a matter of law, amount to a cognizable charge. And the first of those two reasons is the fact that if we accept the dismissal of count one with regard to why he reached out, the reason he reached out, then we must, in connection with 3.8 charge, we must apply that same reasoning and say, wait a second, if he cannot be charged for lack of candor in how he explained to us why he did it, then we must accept under a clear and convincing evidence standard, which has not been met by the finding of the panel, we must accept the fact that he reached out for scheduling purposes, which is exactly what he was charged with and found to be innocent, not culpable, and is exactly what he said in this record below. I reached out for scheduling purposes, and we have a judicial canon, Common 4, which specifically exempts that discussion. So now...
Mr. Nagel, doesn't the judge give two reasons in his statement to the parties? One, I wanted to make sure he signed it. Two, my contact with him was strictly for scheduling purposes. Those are alternate dual reasons that he puts forth.
The answer is, and I'm not sure that one contradicts if one doesn't inform or modify the other, or they can't be read together. The reality is that he reached out for scheduling purposes to clarify certain factual issues. One of those factual issues, which he candidly said, was whether he signed it. Another factual issue is he was confused about a father and son having the same name. That's in the record as well. So the reason why you have a hearing is the reason why you reach out and say, I have some questions regarding the certification, which was truthful. I have questions which I will answer at a hearing. The fact that he didn't say, I'm asking you to appear for a plenary hearing is really irrelevant.
So let's go to what was actually said. And I want to come back to your interesting argument that the dismissal of count one precludes a different finding on count two. But hold that for a second. We'll have plenty of time. You said that implicit, in your brief, you say implicit in this short voicemail message is that it was about scheduling. Here are the words the judge used. I'm reading the transcript from the record. I've got a matter in front of me. I'm Judge Bergman. I've got a matter in front of me, dot, dot, dot. You had submitted an affidavit back in March
I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions about it. Now, there's no mention of scheduling at all. Taking the language at face value, I want to ask you a couple of questions about the affidavit you've submitted. Doesn't that, at face value, appear to extend beyond scheduling?
The answer is, was the message complete? Of course it wasn't complete. However, what's the evidential standard? Can the advisory committee sustain its burden of clear and convincing proof when it's already found that he did not lack candor in giving the exact same answer to the investigative body? It can't. It can't happen. Can't have it both ways.
I want to stick with this and then move on to your second count.
Okay.
Your position is that this is a message about scheduling. Implicit in the language that I read is that this is about scheduling. Where does that come from? What supports that argument?
It comes from his own words, Mr. Chief Justice. It comes from his words to the investigator who said, his words, I'm sorry. It comes, first of all, on the record, when it's disclosed and he goes on the record and he says multiple times, I reached out for scheduling. That's on the record right there when it happened, right contemporaneously.
Please.
I apologize.
No, right.
Then in the investigation, he repeats it. He says it again. And there's a finding that that's not a violation of any canon. There's a finding that must be accepted. It's a finding that that statement, that explanation, cannot be proven by clear and convincing evidence to be untrue.
So if a lawyer gets a call from a judge, and the judge leaves a voicemail message that says, I got your brief, call me back, I have some questions about it. If we freeze frame there, does that, to your thinking, imply this is about scheduling?
I can't give you a straight answer to that because I don't know what's in the judge's head, but I can tell you that along what I've said in the last 10 minutes, that unilateral call without a response, without a connection, in my argument, in my view, does not violate the Judicial Canon of Ethics 3.8.
Different question. I'm asking what a reasonable attorney would believe had been conveyed from that voicemail message.
And I'll answer it this way, and I hope it's not viewed as evasive. I don't think that a reasonable attorney standard applies with an evidential standard of clear and convincing evidence. I just don't. I think a reasonable person, even an objective standard, does not apply. What applies is there clear and convincing evidence that he reached out for reasons other than scheduling? And you can't, respectfully, I don't think that can be found on this record. And then in addition to that, since we have to accept his version of why he reached out as truthful, because the finding of the court finding of the advisory panel with regard to count one says it must be accepted, can't be proven by clear and convincing. If we accept that, then it falls squarely within common four of the canon. And common four says he has a right to reach out in order to make scheduling discussions, determinations, setting, et cetera, et cetera.
So help me understand this, because I know and I understand the reason for your focus on the language. There are two statements made. Is it possible that the ACJC accepts both, that the purpose was to make sure that he signed it, and that the contact was strictly for scheduling purposes, and that those are distinct concepts? And if so, where does that lead us?
The answer is no to that question, because the plenary hearing will flesh out all open issues. So the plenary hearing, as the lead reason for the call, will subsume everything else. So we don't really have to look at, is there a possible independent finding? Do they stand on their own feet? No. When he reaches out to set the hearing date, that's to answer all of the questions. So the secondary question, which, Mr. Chief Justice, you posed to me, I say is subsumed by the very first issue, is I'm reaching out to set a hearing, which is what he told the lawyers on the record and what he told the advisory committee in the investigative process. So those are two reasons.
Where do you find the precise basis in the presentment at 15 and 16 I'm looking at?
Okay, the presentment, I'm I will give you that right now. You will see the formal complaint. You will see that on page 10, Mr. Chief Justice. That's the first count that I've referred to. And then you'll see on, count two, which is again page 10. That's the formal presentment. It really is contained in two paragraphs, 53 and 54. And it is very sparse. It does not say, it does not in any way plead, it doesn't suggest in the presentment that the reason he gave or the reasons, now that you've posed it, he gave were false or misleading. Doesn't say it.
I'm looking at 15 and 16, okay. The analysis of count one, where there's a statement on 16 without that much to it, that we find respondents' statements, plural, did not clearly and convincingly rise to the level of lacking kin.
I'm sorry, I was reading the presentment itself. Are you reading from the opinion of the advisory committee?
I'm reading from the presentment as well, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. And you're at paragraph 16?
Page 15. It doesn't appear to me, and please correct me, that they parsed it with the precision that you're doing so now.
So for some reason, my presentment stops at page 11 of the October 19, 2020 presentment, which is what I'm looking at, the formal complaint. So I apologize, I'm not tracking.
Chief, I think that the confusion is Mr. Nagel is looking at the formal complaint and the chief is referring to the presentment issued by the committee.
You're looking at the wrong thing. 2021 document.
I apologize.
Not at all.
Okay. So we're at page 20 and 21?
15 and 16.
Page 15 and 16.
I'm sorry.
On the December 2021 document.
Sorry. Sorry. Okay. I have that.
Take a moment if you want to glance at it.
At the bottom of 16, just before the last full paragraph, it talks about advising counsel his voicemail was an attempt to confirm his identity and, so there is a second, to learn his availability for a potential plenary hearing. So it does have a finding of two potential issues, and I argue today, as I argued previously, that all of that was to be fleshed out at a hearing which never occurred.
So I didn't read that as their finding. I read the next sentence as their finding, and the two sentences preceding include the one that you had as sort of a summary. Respondent explained during argument, respondent dot, dot, dot. Their finding is, look, he gave multiple rationales. We simply can't find that he lacked candor in providing his explanations, plural.
Yes. And I think that supports my argument. I do.
So let me ask the question again.
Yeah.
Could it be that they're saying he might have been telling the truth on both of them? That A, he was trying to ascertain whether this was truthful, wanted to make sure he signed it, and B, that he was talking about scheduling. And if that's what they're saying, that we can't find that those multiple rationales are satisfactory in the argument that you've made, why does it foreclose a finding on count two?
Because again, if in fact we are bound as we are by clear and convincing evidence, then the advisory committee must choose horses. You can't speculate as to what reasons were in anybody's mind, and you can't speculate as to this finding. So in effect, what I'm hearing, what they found is by using the word explanations with an S, it's the identity is issue number one and scheduling the hearing is issue number two. That's what is on the bottom of page 16. So on those two issues, there is no finding here that the identity was more important or was the motivating factor. It doesn't say that. So in order to get us around the exemption of comment four to the rule, there needs to be some clear and convincing finding with regard to either of those, and there's not.
Are you suggesting that he provided false information when he said, I want to make sure he signed it as one of the rationales.
I'm not suggesting that at all. That's not my argument.
I wouldn't think so.
No, it's not my argument at all. But if he's being charged with a quasi-criminal violation, if he's being charged with a violation of a judicial canon, there must be a finding of the committee as to what it is he violated and why. There's no finding here which says, we find by clear and convincing evidence that he reached out to confirm the identity or the signature, and that does not afford him the exemption of Common Four. It doesn't say that in the opinion. They don't do that. And that's what I've argued. In order not to take advantage of Common Four, which allows a contact if it's for scheduling purposes, there must be some finding by clear and convincing evidence as to why he reached out. It's not
but
in
his... I mean, he says it himself. I don't want to beat this to death, but I wanted to make sure he signed it. I had concerns about the individual. I reached out with the person who signed it. That was his first response to counsel's question as to why that contact was made. It wasn't until the end of that conversation that he throws in, it was strictly for scheduling purposes. So how do we balance that? He says it's strictly for scheduling purposes, but several minutes before, I wanted to know if it was he's the one who signed it. I was concerned about the signature.
Well, I have a fairly simple response to it, Justice, and that's exactly what you do at a hearing. I wanted to schedule because I have questions regarding the affidavit.
That's what he did. Do you know his practice? I don't know if this came up during the course of the hearing. Did he, as a matter of course, call witnesses to schedule matters, or did he depend on staff for that?
Mr. Chief, I don't know the answer to that question.
Do we know how many times in his career he called a witness for scheduling purpose?
That's not in this record, and I would not speculate. I can't tell you one way or the other. We all understand that this was decided on a stipulated record, and that was not addressed in the stipulated record. So that wasn't before the committee. It's not before the court at this point.
In your experience, is it common for judges themselves to contact witnesses regarding scheduling?
I can say in my experience, it's common for judges to call lawyers ex parte. Yes, it in my experience, it is.
But no witnesses, not lawyers.
I haven't been called as a witness to serve, but I certainly have had a lot of contact with judges about a lot of things.
You're a lawyer. I'm talking about your client or witnesses to a case you're involved with. Is that your experience or not?
I don't have direct contact about that. I just know that there are interactions that are fairly common on a day-to-day basis. It's the kind of the nature of how things work in the foxholes.
Did the judge contact the witness before he even contacted the attorneys to schedule this plenary hearing?
The judge reached out to Mr. Osierko in order to schedule a hearing. There was no response, and he issued his opinion literally the next day.
These matters are going to be decided on the papers. Judge decides he has some questions and contacts this witness. Had there even been any discussions with the attorneys about scheduling a plenary hearing before he contacted this witness?
That's not in this record, on the stipulated record. I don't know the answer to that question, but that wasn't part of the stipulated facts that we argued. So I don't have any information outside of what this record is. So I'd like to, if I can, move on to some of the other charges. Are there any other questions that I should address, Mr. Chief? So I want to talk about really the other charges as well. And those charges really tie into a question of Justice Sabatino, of my colleague as well, in terms of the ability of judges to do their own research. Now, what I think is intriguing about this opinion, and I thought it was very forthright, because they really followed one of the key arguments that I had made below, and that is, I had said, there really is no definition in New Jersey as to the scope of a judge's independent research. And without some direction, judges really don't have, and didn't have at the time, guideposts and guidelines. And you'll see at the bottom of page 22 of the presentment, the opinion, the bottom of page 22, the judicial panel, the committee, very candidly says there has not been any New Jersey disciplinary matter directly addressing the limits of independent fact-finding by jurists. So, and that's an interesting starting point for the next phase of my argument. Because
before you start it, though, do you have to distinguish between a jurist who is going to preside over a jury trial and a jurist who is the fact finder?
I don't think so. I think it applies across the board. What's intriguing about that, in addition to the fact that judges had no direction at all up until your honors will make a ruling in this case, what's really intriguing is that you need to read this against the prism of the judicial findings, the judicial notice findings that the evidence rule permits every judge to employ. So every judge has the right on their own to employ and incorporate judicial notice findings. And those are based generally on all the case law. It evolved on public records, which basically is what we have here. And that case law in New Jersey and around the country has even gotten much broader to allow judges to and lawyers to look to websites for factual information, look on the internet for factual information, and look even beyond public records. Now, on this record, Judge Bergman limited himself to the public records. So, how do we reconcile the fact that there's no law at all in New Jersey giving judges direction and limitations on what their fact-finding can be with their right to employ the concepts of judicial notice, which is precisely what he did here? What do we do about that? And I think that just Judge Bergman had every right to feel that he could employ these avenues in order to include certain facts to support his position, even though we've argued and he said in the investigative stage that those facts really were all supported by other findings in the record, his findings of credibility, his findings of the motivation of the party, the trustee and his daughter, the daughter's need to get a bigger house. That was all based upon other testimony in the record. But to impose discipline on just Judge Bergman now, because he afforded himself public access information where the evidence rule specifically allowed him to do that, I don't think that would be appropriate. Now, if the court wants to make rules that judges can look to for the future, that's fine. But right now, where the committee admits that there was no guidelines and the judge properly relied upon his right to employ judicial notice, and he did, I think to discipline him for that is improper. And I think to discipline him for asking his clerk to help him do that under, I think it's 2.1 or 1.1, that also is improper. Because again, he had every right to do what he did based upon the lack of an opinion and based upon the evidence rule, which we all follow. So those are the really the core reasons, because other than the 3.8 argument, the other violations that are alleged are really generally kind of melded into this, the integrity, the bias, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, as Judge Bergman has said, and I think the record shows, you know, there was no finding here that he was in any way, shape, or form biased. No finding by clear and convincing evidence that this evidence bias. So without that finding in the judicial committee's opinion, there certainly cannot be discipline imposed against him. On the issue, and I'm going to move to the discipline issue that Your Honor has suggest I address this. Is there any clarification on any other issue before I go on? I know I've been a little bit long-winded. I apologize.
No, no. We've asked you a lot of questions. You go right ahead.
Okay. So what if there is a finding of a violation here, whether it's one or all of the violations? How should we really discipline a judge who's retired on medical leave, a judge who really had a stellar career over approximately 20 years? What should we do? And I think with the lack of guidelines, and I think with a finding that his explanation that he did it for scheduling purposes really needs to be accepted by the dismissal of count one, I think I would ask that no discipline be entered. And if there is any discipline, it should be the absolute minimum, and at the very worst, a private reprimand. I don't think that this fine jurist for 20 years should end his career on medical leave and medical retirement with a discipline charge against him. I think he's earned the right, if there's discipline, at worst, to have a private reprimand.
If there is discipline, after a very public set of hearings, can it really be private discipline? Does that serve the public?
I struggle with that. In the
interest of transparency.
I struggle with that driving down as to whether even this argument could be sealed in some fashion, because we're arguing the facts of a...
It cannot. It will not.
No, I understand that, and it was a conundrum in my own head as I'm thinking about the argument today. The answer is, for his sake, if there's discipline, it should be private. And we can always argue or always be justified in saying that it was private. And I think that in terms of his perception, I think that would be a very important thing for his perception, whether the public views it otherwise. But I'm here representing a client, and I'm not here representing the views of the public. So with that, I will conclude my argument, and thank you so much for your wonderful attention.
Thank you, Mr. Nagel. Thank you to both counsel. The court will take this under advisement and is in recess.